Hello again, and this is Andrew Corbett, author of the Bible study series, Different, an examination of Paul's epistle to the Colossians for small groups. And we are now in study number 7, which is a different worship. It's based on Colossians chapter 2, verses 16 to 23, which says, "Therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food or drink or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. These are a shadow of the things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Let no one disqualify you, insisting on asceticism and worship of angels, going on in detail about visions, puffed up without reason by his sensuous mind, and not holding fast to the head, from whom the whole body, nourished and knit together through its joints and ligaments, grows with a growth that is from God. If with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the world, why, as if you were still alive in the world, do you submit to the regulations? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch," referring to the things that all perish as they are used, according to human precepts and teachings. These have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism and severity to the body, but they are of no value stopping the indulgence of the flesh. And we're going to have a look at that now. Again, I would just encourage you to let there be a time when those people who are part of your group can share how they're going, and that can happen under the veil of what would you like prayer for? And before that, what are you thankful for? And that gives people an opportunity to share maybe some good news or maybe some challenging news. And once they've done that and you've taken note of those things, because as group leader at the end, you remind people such and such wanted prayer for this and such wanted prayer for that. And then you would bring up those prayer requests at the end of the meeting and pray for each of those requests. This is a different worship. So we're going to look at the relationship between worship and religion. So let's have a look at this first paragraph. Religion is based on a set of beliefs about God and how these beliefs shape how we view the world, treat each other, and regard our purpose. The heart of any religion is revealed by what it teaches about worship, particularly how it is to be done and why it should be done. So that you could ask a question, you know, unscripted question. So why do you think as Christians, we need to worship? You might ask another question. Why do you think some Christians actually worship? And depending on the range of answers, you may get answers like, well, if we worship, it's going to give us more favor with God. Or we worship because it's an aspect of spiritual warfare that helps us to get better answers to our prayers, or something like that. If those are the sorts of answers that you get, I'd be interested if you were to ask that question at the end of this study. So why should we worship? And hopefully where that's going to land is that we worship because God is worthy of our worship. For even if he does nothing more for us, he is utterly worthy of our worship. And I hope that's where we land. Okay, question one. According to James 1:26, which says, "If anyone thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue but deceives his heart, this person's religion is worthless." So it's worth pointing out that religion itself is not necessarily bad. But when it's not heartfelt, when it's not coming from the heart, when it's not done with an attitude that aligns the worshiper with the will of the one they are worshiping, then it is rather pointless. So in this particular passage, the question is, what makes a person's religion worthless, or, to use another translation, futile? And it says here, if they do not bridle their tongue, then they are, they are deceiving their heart. This person's religion is worthless. So if someone, you know, on Sunday worships God, but then on a Monday carries on in a way that does not honor Christ in the way they speak, then their worship, their religion is rather pointless. So what makes a person's religion worthless or futile? When they don't speak the way God would have them to speak. Question two. Look, so what does James state is a characteristic of pure and undefiled religion? James 1:27, the next verse there. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep one's self unstained from the world. So there's a couple of things there. The compassion for those who are less fortunate than ourselves. This shows that our religion is one that is based on compassion, which reflects the heart of God. And then secondly, to keep oneself unstained from the world. And that sounds like maintaining moral purity, particularly when you are interacting with the vulnerable that many people, I'm imagining, would have taken advantage, perhaps, of the vulnerable in a way that was completely inappropriate. And so here we have the apostle saying that anyone who visits widows and orphans, that is, the vulnerable, and they remain pure, morally pure, their religion is actually of great value. So that's the answer to that question. Be interesting to see what discussion comes up around this, whether people bring out examples of hypocrites. And you may even ask that as an unscripted question. Have you ever met a religious hypocrite? And what gave you the idea that they were a hypocrite? Question three, Christianity introduced to the world a new way to worship. And perhaps as Christians, we take this for granted, but even the whole notion of singing is almost an exclusively Christian concept. And question three says, what elements of Christian worship are mentioned by the Apostle Paul in Colossians chapter 3, verse 16? So we are jumping ahead a little bit, but it says this: let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in all wisdom, singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in your hearts to God. So we take for granted today the singing aspect of that. Let the word of Christ dwell richly. So there we have the centrality of the preaching of the word. But we also have worship done by singing, music and singing. How do you think this compared to the way people of other religions worshipped when Paul wrote this epistle? And almost certainly they did not gather to hear instruction and sing, with the exception of Jewish communities. And again, the emphasis was on the teaching of the law, not on worship involving singing. So Christianity elevated singing to a plateau previously not seen before in worship. Worship is how we express our surrender to God. It can involve praise, which can involve music and singing, something almost unique to Christian worship. So again, I'm making this point. So while some people see music as essentially promoting evil and sensuality, Vishal Mangalwadi, in his book, The Book That Made Your World, argues that it was the Bible and Christianity in particular that redeemed music as a means by which a worshipper could glorify God. He writes, "Music is, of course, integral to the Bible, in which the longest book is Psalms. The last psalm, for example, asks creation to praise the Lord with the trumpet, lute, harp, tambourine, strings, pipe, and cymbals." That's on page 12 of Mangalwadi's book. He goes on to describe how one of the church's earliest thinkers, Augustine, wrote a 6-volume philosophy of music called On Music, in which he saw the close parallel between mathematics and music. Since Augustine reasoned, the universe displays mathematical orderliness, in other words, things are a certain distance apart and so on, music must therefore be ordained by God, and its appreciation must be built deep into the soul of every person. Mangalwadi goes on to reflect that strict Islam forbids music. Now, he gives examples of that on page 10, as does pure Buddhism. Again, that they ban music. Question four, Paul was concerned that the Colossians were being confused by some Jewish converts to Christianity known as Judaizers, who were insisting that all Gentiles needed to become Jews first in order to become Christians. Now, reading Colossians 2:16, which we read just a moment ago, let's read it again. Therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food or drink, or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. So those things were particularly kept by Jews. Reading that verse and note some of the things these Judaizers must have been telling the Colossians to do that was necessary for their salvation. So we see that the apostle mentions festivals and new moons and Sabbaths and so on. It's reasonable that that's exactly what they were telling the Colossians as well. And perhaps you've heard, and this might be again another unscripted question, where perhaps people have heard that to really worship God you need to do this, do that, do this, and so on. Be interesting just to throw it out there as a question. Question five: how does Paul describe these things in Colossians 2:17, and what did he mean by this? Now note Hebrews 8:5. Which says they serve as a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. When Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." And Hebrews chapter 10 verse 1, "For since the law has but a shadow of the good things to come instead of the true form of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every year, make perfect those who draw near." So Colossians 2:17 also refers to this concept of these old things being a shadow. Colossians 2:17, it says, "These are a shadow of things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ." So how does Paul describe these things? Well, he describes them as a shadow. So these things of festivals and new moon festivals and which day you keep as a Sabbath is described by Paul as a shadow. And whoever the writer to the Hebrews is, says that those things passed away. Those things are done and dusted. Those things were just a shadow of what Christ has ultimately done. So for example, the Sabbath, the time when no work was to be done and rest was to happen and they were to come together to worship as a community, all of that's now fulfilled in the Old Covenant. We still come together to meet to worship, but it's all transferred to the Sunday, first day of the week. But the idea of having to rest so that you could be saved, so do no work so that you would be saved, is ultimately fulfilled in Christ. Christ has done the work. We indeed can do no work to be saved. So those Old Testament principles were shadows. Question six, who did Jesus say that the Father is looking for? And how are they to relate to God? So John chapter 4, verses 23 and 24. "But the hour is coming and is now here when true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth." At the very least, this means that our worship should be utterly heartfelt. Utterly heartfelt. The truth component, at the very least, means that when we worship, our lives become transformed so that we honor not just the God we're worshiping with our worship, but we honor him with our lives. We're truthful to what he has taught. Question seven, Colossians 2:19, "And not holding fast to the head, from whom the whole body, nourished and knit together through its joints and ligaments, grows with a growth that is from God." So according to that verse, how does a person become truly spiritual and then grow towards spiritual maturity? Well, by being connected to Christ. Christ is the head, we are the body, and we are nourished, and we're knit together one with another by being connected to Christ. And that's how we move on to spiritual maturity. Question eight, Note what Paul lists as religious practices in Colossians 2, 20 and 21. If with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the world, why, as if you were still alive in the world, do you submit to the regulations? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. So the question is, those practices that he's just mentioned, how are they described in the verses after that, verses 22 and 23? Referring to the things that all perish. So that's the first way he describes them, as they are used according to human precepts. So that's another way he describes them, and teaching. So he describes them as almost man-made things. These things have been added to the law of God itself. Verse 23, these have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism. So asceticism is denying oneself in the name of your religion, and severity to the body, but they are of no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh. In other words, those things won't stop you from sinning. In fact, they may well increase your sinning. So what can we learn for how we worship from this passage in Colossians? Well, hopefully we can learn that worship must be, it absolutely has to be from the heart. We have to be a people who are worshiping God because we love God, and we recognize that God is worthy of our worship. Therefore, we take great delight in worshiping Him. And I hope that we've picked that up from this study. I hope also that we see that even the act of singing actually is something that is quite potent. It's quite powerful. And we as Christians should recognize that when we worship, singing is a vital part of it. Anyway, I hope that you pick up that I'm saying, look, ask some questions that are unscripted questions, and that the whole point of this is to bring people to recognize what Paul is emphasizing is true religion, which is another way of saying this is true worship. This is what worship should be. It's not a matter of outward form. It's a matter of an expression of the inward reality of what Christ has done in our lives. All right, bless you, and I'll be back to talk about study 8 in our next session.